This week on Out of the Air, our whole show features the husband-wife team of 24/7 Productions LLC, Jack and Kim Olesker, discussing their four-decade career in television, film, and novels, plus Kim's two decades of work in the nonprofit arena, currently serving as president and CEO of Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce. Our spotlight's on the Port County Symphony Sound of Spring concert Sunday, March 9th at 3 p.m. at Holcroft Performing Arts Center.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight from the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra, and she's going to tell us all about their next concert, but we're also going to talk about some of them that we just saw a few weeks ago. Both Esther and I had the privilege because we were invited to go see it, and it was great. It was the Animal Kingdom concert. We'd like to welcome back the Executive Director for the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra, Emily Yannis. Welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Emily.
So you had a very successful concert. It was kind of interesting. I know I took my grandson to his very first concert at 4 and a half.
He's adorable. Yes, he was so cute.
He's so cute.
Yeah. And then he got to try out the violin. He did like the woodwind. He didn't get as far as playing an instrument, which is unusual because his mother is a saxophone player. But he did blow a couple times on the trumpet and got that pretty good. That was my instrument.
Great.
So tell us about some of the things that happened at the concert.
Yeah. Oh, it was just a terrific night. It was a terrific turnout. We had, as you mentioned, the instrument petting zoo was a huge success. Thank you to
Very
Quinlan
successful.
And Favish. Yeah, for sponsoring that. I think, you know, people of all ages enjoyed getting their hands on some instruments. I saw some adults taking part as well. But it was just so fun to see the kids just get their hands on those instruments and try them out. And it's just a great way to get kids excited about potentially learning an instrument.
Right. And they were so patient with the kids. I mean, really worked with them until they got their breath.
Yeah, they're the pros. That's what they do. So
we're
very grateful to have a great partnership with Quinlan and Fabish.
I know Morgan, who was doing the strings, she was actually one of my former students from Munster.
Oh, really?
She was never on stage in theater, but she played quite a few of my pits and everything. So,
oh, sure.
And of course,
Morgan is awesome. She works for Quinlan and Fabish.
And Bethany Borgo, who plays... and she's another one of my former students, so both on stage and in the pit. So yeah, we had some.
You've got a few of them up there.
Reunion. So, and tell us a little bit about the music. And I have to say, you were the narrator, and that added so much to it, especially identifying the sounds and everything. I think, especially
I
for a 4 and a half year old sitting there, who was sat pretty still for the whole thing. You know.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah,
that's impressive. Yeah. So we played Peter and the Wolf, which has a narrator role written into it. It introduces the instruments and the characters of the story, and then kind of tells the story as it goes along. And I think that people really enjoyed that. That's a classic by Prokofiev. Has been played for, you know, children's concerts for many, many years, but many people were excited to hear it. And then our Carnival of the Animals, Dr. Watson wrote me a short script just to announce each movement, kind of give the audience an idea of what they were going to hear. And similarly with Dangerous Creatures, the Australian piece, just so that to give the audience some context and storytelling along with those pieces.
Some excitement too. I really loved your introductions to everything, and you have a beautiful speaking voice. It was very
thanks. I really had fun doing it. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
And of course, we know she has a beautiful singing voice. I know for the Dangerous Creatures, a couple of times Grayson, my grandson, said, "Papa, that's loud."
because that black bear movement at the beginning is quite loud.
Yeah, it's quite an opening.
So it is. You have coming up now the next concert. So tell us a little about that.
Yeah. So March 9th, we have The Sounds of Spring at the Holdcraft Performing Arts Center in Michigan City, 3:00. That's a Sunday afternoon, central time there. We are excited about this one and hopeful that maybe the weather will cooperate with a little bit of spring that day. It's early March, so no telling what it will be like. But we're going to play the centerpiece of the program is Schumann's First Symphony, the Spring Symphony, which is a really wonderful classic. And the orchestra is really looking forward to playing it under the direction of Carolyn Watson. The other showpiece is going to be a world premiere of a xylophone concerto by a Danish composer by the name of Kjell Røyker. I think I'm saying that correctly. Mm-hmm. And our education and community outreach manager and percussionist Jared Collar has been working really closely with the publishers on this one for this world premiere, because it was actually recently discovered and published. And so it has never been played. And so this is a really exciting opportunity for us to play this piece that has never been heard by audiences. And so Jared has been working diligently with the publisher on this one, getting all the scores, and then of course practicing the very difficult concerto on the xylophone that you'll get to hear.
He's soloing on that, right?
He is soloing, yes, and it's very virtuosic, lots of mallets, lots of extremely difficult mallet techniques on that one. So I think people are really going to enjoy it. It's something a little different, something you don't always get to see every day. And I think that's going to be a real treat.
And then you have two more concerts coming up, both a summer one and one where I think you're going to be performing. And tell us briefly about
that.
That's right.
Yes. April 12th. I've been saying all of my musical theater dreams are coming true, because I love to sing musical theater. And this is a Rodgers and Hammerstein tribute of the golden age of Broadway. So we're going to be doing some of the best loved tunes, things from The Sound of Music, The King and I, Oklahoma, and a couple of Chicago singers, really wonderful professional singers from Chicago, are going to come in and join me for that. So it's going to be a really fun, exciting, enchanted evening Auditorium, April 12th.
And then quickly in the summer, you have one event there.
That's right. Yes. Our traditional outdoor free concert in Friendship Botanic Gardens. We've set the date for that. It will be Sunday, July 20th. At 7:00 p.m. there in Friendship Botanic Gardens. And you can find more information about that on our website, lcso.net.
And that's great. That's LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. The Executive Director, Emily Yannis, is in LaPorte County Symphony, The Sounds of Spring. It's March 9th at 3 p.m., Holdcraft Performing Arts Center in Michigan City. Emily, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight, sharing your upcoming season events.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Jack and Kim Olesker to Art on the Air. Kim is an award-winning producer, director, with a long history in the entertainment industry. She serves as the executive vice president of and on the board of directors for 24/7 Productions. She has spent over two decades in the nonprofit arena with positions at the American Cancer Society, United Way, focusing on early childhood development. In addition to her duties with 24/7 Productions, Kim is presently the president and CEO of Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce and also a talented and avid knitter. Jack is the president and CEO of 24/7 Productions and has a career that spans over four decades and includes writing, directing, producing over 1,200 episodes of television, 18 films, and seven published novels. His first novel, No Place Like Home, was published by Putnam, and then MGM purchased the novel for film rights. In recent years, he has written, produced, and directed documentaries, many for PBS. Today, he continues his work in motion pictures and television, developing and creating mass market entertainment content in mystery, suspense, drama, and comedy genres. He also has a weekly newspaper column for the New Buffalo Times, A Writer's Life During the Golden Age of Television Animation. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Kim and Jack, meeting you.
Thank you, Esther. My gosh, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. If I ever need a new PR agent, you're going to get my first call.
Oh, well, here I am.
Well, welcome to Art in the Air. And how we always like to format our show is get to know our guests, their background and everything. And Jack, we're going to start with you. Your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now, at least up until Kim and you met her.
Well, my gosh, you're giving me a softball, so I'll thank you for that. Okay, it's kind of high and outside. I can put the wood to the ball on that one. My origin really goes back to my roots in Chicago, and I'm going to take you back to 1953. And my mother took me as a four-year-old to the main branch of the Chicago Public Library. And in those days, ladies would wear white wrist gloves, and they'd have a pillbox hat with a veil down the top of it. And she got me dressed up in this wonderful little camel hair suit coat. And we walked into the main branch of the Chicago Public Library, and I could hear, I still remember hearing her high heels clicking on the marble floors. And we walked up to the head librarian, and she said, "This is my son, Jack. I want him to find out about the world of books." And the head librarian, her desk, you know, he could land like a fighter plane on her desk if it was an aircraft carrier. She said, "Well, I'm going to take you into the future and back into the past. And you're going to go to Roman times, and you're going to go on adventures in space and under the sea." She said, "You're going to find out all about the wonderful world of books." And she said, "Now come with me." And she took me on a tour of the library with my mother. Now, I'm sure that everybody...
Sounds like Willy Wonka.
Yeah, I'm sure that everybody that walked into the library didn't get this treatment. I'm sure that my mother set it up ahead of time. But, you know, looking back, it's three quarters of my lifetime or more. And I still appreciate the gesture, and it got me started. And that was my origin story. And then going to Harvard School for Boys at the South Side of Chicago. And we had a wonderful headmaster, Jerry Clapper. He'd crumple up a piece of paper, drop it on the desk, and he'd say, "Write a composition about that." And other kids would be asking, "How long should it be?" "I'm writing and writing and writing." And he'd send a note to my next teacher, "Let Jack stay late for class. He's writing." And the next year, my sophomore year, I had Carol Stein, who drilled us every week, a wonderful teacher, drilled us on Greek word roots, Roman word roots, diagramming sentences. Who diagrams sentences nowadays? So between my mother exposing me to books and then Jerry Clapper, and he was the headmaster of Harvard School for Boys. He was a true Renaissance man, head of the Great Books Foundation in Chicago, former Green Beret. From him giving me the freedom of the English language and then Carol Stein teaching me the discipline of it, it was like a key clicked inside of me. And, you know, obviously, you know, I'm blessed, very blessed to have received God-given talent. But to have parents and teachers that steer you and are your mentors, that was an integral part and a very fortunate part of my life. Kimmy, over to you.
Mine is a little simpler. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, so I am a definite Midwestern gal. I have two brothers. Went to Catholic school 12 years, went to the University of Nebraska at Omaha thinking I would live and work in Omaha my entire life. Graduated from there, traveled for my sorority for a year and never came back to Omaha. So moved to Kansas City and went on a girls trip to the Bahamas where I met him. So, so lifetime later, 30 years later and 28 years married, coming up on 29 and 31 respectively. You know, we've lived in multiple places. So I've lived in Kansas City twice. He's lived there once. We lived in Boca Raton for 5 years. And then we moved back up here to Northwest Indiana where we wanted to raise our children. So we chose this area. We knew the benefits, we knew the beauty of it. And we have three beautiful children that have been raised through the Catholic school system here in Michigan City. So
I can tell you that getting Kim to eventually be my wife, we've been married for 28 years, going on 29. It was not an easy task. You got to remember, I'm living and working in the Bahamas. I worked with the broadcast network of the Bahamas there. And Kim's living in Kansas City. And we met for like 5 days. She didn't see much of her girlfriends during that 5 days. And by the time she got back to Kansas City, she had 24 roses waiting on her desk when she returned and a ticket to come back to the Bahamas. And she would fly from Kansas City to Dallas, from Dallas to Miami, take a hopper over to Nassau. And it was an effort because it was a long distance relationship. But, you know, it's a campaign like what General Patton used to do. And I'm glad that it's a campaign that I was, and I hope Kim feels, we were both victorious in.
You won that battle, I guess, so.
Yeah. So, Kim, what was your childhood household like? Because you've gone into very altruistic work with non-for-profits. Was that an example your parents had set? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. My dad worked for the Omaha Public Power, which is the equivalent of NIPSCO or NiSource. So he started there the day he graduated and had it mapped out to when he was going to retire at 52 or 53 years old and had never looked back. He was one of the chief accounting people there. So I don't know if it was actual CFO back then, but, you know, he knew his route. So he was the main breadwinner. My mom stayed home. She did some odd jobs. She was a secretary and she did a couple things just to, once we were all in school and, you know, able to manage ourselves after school. But for the most part, she was home most every day when we got home. And so she really, you know, she was a strong, solid figure. She was Irish, so she was very ornery. But that's probably why, you know, I'm as resilient as I am because I had her and I had my two brothers. So we just grew up never throwing anything away. We always gave it to whoever needed it. We lived with donating. We lived with taking care of others. We had some elderly neighbors that we always took meals to on holidays and when we had big dinners. So it was just always inherent in our family structure. We just always took care of each other. When we had, you know, new folks coming into the Catholic school who didn't have uniforms, we made sure that they got uniforms, you know. And so it was just always in our nature to take care of each other. We did fine financially. We didn't need it ourselves, but we certainly knew who needed it in our parish. I was actually part of a very poor parish. So it was just part of our being, part of our fabric.
One comment I want to ask him is, how did Jack really win you over? What was the thing that finally said, okay, I guess I'll spend my life with this guy?
I don't know if it was one thing. I think it was genuinely showing me his actions through a couple of, you know, times that we were together. And I think that, you know, the fact that he was from the Midwest was a big big checkbox for me. I had been all over the U.S. with traveling for the sorority. So it was just, you know, I'm most comfortable with the Midwest mentality. It's a very different mentality than the East Coast or the West Coast or the South or the North or South of the North. And so, you know, I think that was part of it. I knew that our values were the same. I think it was probably one of the trips that we went down where he ended up high centering the car into a ditch in the Bahamas where he thought, I don't know why he thought he could jump in and push it out, but they, you know, they decided to mark the hole like 2 seconds before the hole actually happened. So very typical Bahamian mentality. We love the Bahamas people, but they don't plan 20 feet ahead like we do, or a mile. Well, there's only 20 miles on the island, so I don't know how much more they could have given us notice. But the car went into the hole, and so he's like, "I'll go push." Like, that sounded like a good idea. And so, long story short, we all survived, thankfully, but could have been a very different night had somebody come up behind us and hit us and hit him into the hole. But I think that was probably the night that we were like, this is the normal side of him, not the showy, trying to look the best, for like the perfect date kind of thing. So I think that was probably the night that we both probably fell in love.
Yeah.
We realized that it was just, that we are normal and that there's no showiness to sometimes, and that we need to. And, coming through that situation, it was, it tells a lot about a person that you're able to, get out of the hole.
Yeah, that he jumps right in.
He jumps right in. And I got behind the wheel, and it was a stick shift. And I was like, oh, I don't even see him. I don't even know if he's down there. I don't know how deep that hole goes. So I had visions of, U.S., tourist in jail for a missing date.
I had a bottle of wine that I had opened, I'm two blocks from
the ocean.
There's flies now, fruit flies going around the bottle of wine by the time we get back. And I'm drenched. I'm covered in mud. And I had Tony Roma's ribs in the freezer. They're dried up, and the candles were down to stubs. And I turned to Kim, looked like a drowned rat, and I said, "Gosh, I just wanted us to have a nice evening and everything." She says, "Just go shower. We're still going to have a wonderful time this weekend." And I looked at her, and my hair is down to my face. And I said, "You know what? Either you're out of your mind or you're the woman I'm going to marry." Here we are. And the other thing that I'll say, I hear Kim talking about her background, and we're very different people. Listen, opposites attract. There's no question about it. And, I've always believed that, modesty is an overrated virtue. Okay. I think, you have to blow your horn. It was Muhammad Ali that said, "It's not bragging if it's true." And Kim's not that way. But I will tell you, she has a 25-year history and nonprofits, and also directing and producing films. And when she was with the American Cancer Society, before they did their marches, she would go out and put up the signs on hurricane fences. And when she rose from being the regional childhood development executive at United Way, working with former Indiana Governor Mike Pence, and who else did you work with, Kim? Was it Mike?
Mitch Daniels.
And she's too modest to talk about these things. And, I remember a number of years ago, your viewers may remember, we had a once-in-a-lifetime flood in Indiana. Torrential rains were drowning. And Kim went for a weekend, and she called all of her volunteers into the office, and they're calling up hundreds and hundreds of people. And one fella gets on the phone with her, and he says, "I'm knee-deep in my basement, and my children are upstairs, and all the lights are out, and we're getting cold." And Kim said, "I'm going to get you a new furnace." And she got on the phone. In an hour, it was delivered to this guy's house and was hooked up. And he said to her, he called her back, he said, "I just never knew that there were people like you." Mm. And that's the kind of thing she does with her pro-social endeavors. And it's certainly one of the reasons that has kept us so close, because we have shared values. She does what she does working with her region, whether it was with United Way or whether it was American Cancer Society or now with Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce. And she touches so many lives in our region. And, I've been blessed to be able to do that with programs like the Power Rangers and the Care Bears and Inspector Gadget. And I brought, I hope, smiles to a lot of your listeners' lives when they were young, and perhaps to their children as well. So that's doing pro-social work and touching people and making their lives a little bit better is the cement that has created such a strong three-decade bond between my wife and I. Whenever anybody says, what do you really think about Kim, Jack? I always use the line from Mark Twain: "Wheresoever she is, there is Eden." And then I quickly add, she's got a pretty good deal too.
Well, Kim, I was going to ask you about your other endeavors. Jack covered most of it. Is there anything you'd like to add? I know you're currently the president and CEO of the Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce, which I know Lakeshore Public Media is kind of building relationships with. But just maybe anything that Jack didn't cover, maybe briefly tell us about some of those nonprofit things.
Yeah, especially, you know, the early childhood aspect of everything, how you got involved with that.
Yeah. So American Cancer was doing great stuff with the Relays for Life, and I did the Coaches versus Cancer. So I handled the golf outing for Coach Bray over at University of Notre Dame. That's a big outing. It was $100,000+ in fundraising. And so they went through a national downsizing. And so I was part of that downsizing. And that's when I stumbled across United Way. And I thought, this looks like a great organization. I've always given to them out of my checks. What do they do? So they needed that early childhood person. And I had children. That was really my only qualifying, aside from my nonprofit work, my only qualifying trait was I had three children that were thriving, living, breathing, you know, eating, walking and everything. So I haven't tortured them yet, but you know, I had applied, and luckily, it was a consortium. So it was a shared position between LaPorte, Porter, and Lake County, which was good because that was truly a regional, you know, essential for getting good early childhood opportunities for that three, four and five year old children. So LaPorte had their own version of kinder camp. Lake didn't have any kinder camp. Porter County wanted to start it, so we started it. And so what I did was I added STEM curriculum with the help of, at the time it was Arcelor Middle, now it's Cleveland Cliffs, but they were a big funder. BP was a big funder. And so we used those funds to develop curriculum for STEM. State of Indiana says you don't need to do STEM until sixth grade or third grade or something. And I'm like, you know, I've got third graders. They don't wake up good on third grade day one and say, I am so excited about science and math. So we wanted to make sure that these 4 and 5 year olds had the same opportunities that the children where you could afford to put them in a nice preschool or put them in a great kindergarten camp or put them in Catholic school or whatever, you know, so that everybody had the same kind of opportunity. So we used that kinder camp model, and it was duplicated in multiple districts in the state of Indiana through our Indiana United Way network. And it was a phenomenal program. We really made sure that we had testing from the start to finish. So they did the kindergarten testing. And so we knew that there was growth in that 5 weeks of kinder boot camp is basically what it was. So so that, you know, that spawned a little bit of symmetry in the state, because I was on the early learning advisory committee for the governor, at the time it was Pence, and we were doing massive research on how to fund kindergarten for the whole state. Indiana doesn't require kindergarten. So we have kids showing up first grade, not holding a pencil, not holding pen, having never sat still for longer than 20 minutes at a time. And so we just wanted to make that opportunity for access available. And so I then rolled out on my way pre-K to Lake County and to LaPorte County and a little bit of Porter. It was a capacity issue with Porter. We just didn't have the seats. And so we had a lot of great, you know, opportunities there. We just didn't have a lot of seats or expansion opportunities. So we went with Lake. We went with a little bit of LaPorte, and we got more kids in the seats. We ended up putting about 2,000 5-year-olds in kindergarten, full year kindergarten. And that meant food at the beginning of the day, food at lunch, food, you know, a snack in the afternoon, safe, you know, safe 8 hours a day. They got them home. They got them, you know, situated with their little lives. It involved their parents, some parent track, you know, training and stuff. So it was a phenomenal program, and it's still going today. So
it just glows, really.
Great thing.
You know, yeah. I'll tell you, I'm so proud of Kim for her work in early childhood development. Obviously, once she moved into the C-suite, became the president and CEO, she extended her reach. But for that work that she did at Kinder Camp, and my life has been involved with children for the last, my gosh, 40 years. But the lives that she changed. You know, she's 100% right. If these children don't get into preschool, if they don't get that early education that she and Governor Pence and Mitch Daniels were responsible for, then they're going to spend the rest of their lives trying to catch up. They'll always be behind. You know, next to unconditional love, the most important thing you can give to your children is reading. And she was the impetus of making that happen. And, you know, I always say when people say, oh, you know, why are you doing writing and everything? I say, you throw a rock into a pond and you watch the ripples and you hope that they reach fertile shores. And in Kim's case, I'm sure that her Kinder Camp initiative reached fertile shores with at-need inner city children that didn't have the opportunities that our children were blessed with. And who knows, because some child that she helped out was able to get that preschool training and then was on a level playing field, maybe that child grows up and he ends up going to Howard University, or he ends up going to Johns Hopkins and he ends up being the doctor that's going to find the cure for the breast cancer that brought my mother down. So I'm so respectful of her for all that she's done in her career, and I really admire her for that. And I don't have to say that just because I love her. I say that because I respect her.
Well, Jack, we appreciate that. And you're listening to Jack and Kim Oeschner on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM, telling us their story and their background.
So, Jack, there's like something that I'm just burning to sort of know. So when I think about you writing, is it a singular experience for you, or are you in a room like Dick Van Dyke and Sally and Morty, you know, or Buddy and Sally, you know? So are you playing all the characters as you're writing, or are you bouncing off other people?
I'm playing all the characters, and, you know, it's a very solitary existence for me. And, you know, it's kind of like I'm on house arrest 5 days a week until the weekend comes, and I'm in front of that computer 10, 12, sometimes 14 hours or more a day. But, you know, the playwright Noel Coward once said, work is much more fun than fun. And he was 100% right. I love so much what I'm doing. But right. The flip side of that coin is that unless I'm in production and we're on a set, which I love as well, then I lead that solitary existence. And it's important for me to have input from people so that I can take it and synthesize it and use it in what I'm doing. A couple of years ago, Kim and I were at the Stray Dog in New Buffalo. My gosh, it's kind of like our office. And on the weekends, you can't even move in the place. And Mark Tenace, the owner, and Joey DiMaggio, who used to be the manager there, they would out me if there were like three or four young couples from Chicago. And one night, there's three couples, young people, on the other side of the bar, and the place is packed. And they start chanting, Power Rangers, Power Rangers. And I smile. And they send me over a fireball shot, you know. So I had the guys come over and I'm arm wrestling with them. And their young ladies they're with are talking with Kim. And after about 3 hours, you know, we had such a wonderful evening. We start to walk out. And this one young woman comes up to me. She says, Mr. Oeschner, can I talk to you for a moment? I said, sure. I said, as long as you call me Jack. I said, Mr. Oeschner's up in heaven looking down. Thought about it. Maybe he was a tough businessman. Maybe he's down below.
You don't know.
I said, what can I do for you? So she says, well, and the place is packed, you know, it's raucous. And she says, you know, I know you did the Care Bears. She said, I want you to know I grew up in a very dysfunctional family. My father was verbally abusive to my mother all the time. And she said, it was very difficult for me. And she said, on the weekends, she said, I waited all week for the Care Bears. Oh. And it would come on Saturdays, and she says, it was an oasis for me. And she says, I want to thank you for saving my childhood.
Aww.
Well, you know, I grew up on the South Side, tough streets, 47th and Ellis going to school. And then I went into the U.S. Air Force. I was a search and rescue combat medic. They used to lower me out of a helicopter to pick up down crewmen. All my fingers are broken from fights. And then I went out to L.A., which made everything else look like a cakewalk. But when those young ladies said that to me, you know, I'm a tough guy, but I started tearing up. And she says, "Do you mind if I?" She says, "Do you mind if I hug you?" And I said, "I'm good, honey." So, you know, I've been blessed to have a wonderful career. It's 40 years and 1,200 episodes of television, like Larry said. But that's the reason that you write. That's the reason that Kim does what she does. Well, it's nice to have a nice house. It's nice to go on a nice vacation. But when you can touch someone's life, especially as Kim has done so many times, especially when they are in the heart of darkness, and you can lead them a little bit towards the light, it's like that old commercial for the credit cards used to say, the cost of all these different things, but doing that, priceless. Okay, so
yeah, you're making me tear up, Jack.
That's why we do what we do.
So with your, you know, you have such an animated personality and voice. Have you ever voiced one of the characters that you've written?
Oh, gosh, no. I stay strictly on the other side of the camera. Kim has had a lot of on-camera experience. She's fabulous with it. She was a host of a PBS show called Sit and Knit with Kim, Jack, and Bird that was shot up in South Bend. Yep. Pilot episode we shot. And when we were down in the Bahamas, we were working with the broadcast network of the Bahamas on a wonderful festival they have called Junkanoo. And kind of like the Mardi Gras equivalent of,
but clean.
But very clean. Yeah, very, very clean. It's Bahamas, very conservative. And we're in a committee meeting and, you know, I'm the executive producer and the producer and we're with six or seven people. I said, you know what? Why don't we give Kim a microphone and she'll get down on the street with these 10,000 performers and she'll start interviewing people on the side and interviewing some of the performers. I said, she'll be fabulous at it. And I look at Kim, she's turning like ashen. And sure enough, that's what we did. And when we had that Junkanoo project, I was one of the hosts and Kim was down in the midst of a Bay Street in the bottom.
Of the drum line, yes.
So she's the one that's on the other side of the camera. I like to write, produce, and direct and stay on my side of the camera.
Okay. So when you approach a project, tell us about maybe your process. I mean, you obviously, and we'll touch on some of the things you've already done, but tell us your process. How do you get the idea for characters, story, everything like that, whether it be for a novel or for television or for a film?
Well, I got this little shop on 7th and Franklin in Michigan City, and they sell me their ideas for $1.79. No, just kidding.
I think everything you look at probably inspires you.
You know, Esther, you hit the nail on the head, okay? I can't turn it off. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm blessed that I can't turn it off. When Kim and I were on our honeymoon, I took her on the grand tour to Rome and then up to the south of France. We drove through the countryside and we ended up in England. But we were in Paris and, you know, this is the first time she's seen the Eiffel Tower. And I'm taking it to her and I'm explaining, you know, Gustav Eiffel built it. And at the time, it was a huge cause célèbre, cause terrible in France. Everybody wanted it torn down. They felt it was a blight on the French landscape. Victor Hugo wrote a scathing article about it. And I'm telling Kim all of this, and then I started thinking about it. I said, you know, what if there was this architect who was so irritated, and he put on a hood and a mask, and at night he would go on the Eiffel Tower and he would push off people that were working on it, and he becomes a serial killer to stop the Eiffel Tower. And I'm going on for like about 5 minutes on a rant, and I'm silent. And I look, and Kim's like looking at me. I said, "What is it?" She said, "You've been away from your computer for too long." So, ideas are everywhere. You know, I know when I was living in Chicago, I read an article in the Tribune. It was just about, you know, there was like a gang war going on. It didn't have anything to do with China. And this reporter said it was like a Tong war. And I didn't know what a Tong was, but it struck a chord with me. And I started researching it. And before I knew it, I got pulled into about a year's research on China and the gold rush in California. And I wrote a book called The Young Dragons. So you never know, Esther, where it's going to spring from. You can hear one little word and that's it. You know, you're off to the races. So the most important thing for me is I keep my radar on. I listen to everything, and I don't allow pomposity in my life, because you never know where the next great idea is going to be coming from.
Well, and speaking, this is like a Kim Jack question, I think. So at what pivotal point does 24/7 happen in your careers?
Well, that would be back in the Bahamas. I was coming out of a difficult business relationship that I had to sever. And I severed it. It was costly. I'm working one night I'm a man without a flag. Okay, I'm a man without a country. I'm starting a new company. And Kim walks into my office and she says, "Honey, it's almost 3 o'clock in the morning." I said, "Well, you know, I'm working on something." And in a huff, as she walked out of my office, she says, "You know, you just work 24/7. And it was like, boom. You know, I said, "That's the name of my production company, because I do work 24/7. I take off, I take off for Christmas, and I take off for our anniversary, and I don't always take off for our anniversary." So that's how 24/7 Productions
was born.
Yeah. I guess, you know, with an offhand remark, and that's why you got to be always listening. You know, always listening.
Yeah, and it's been off and on in my career, but, you know, when we had when we were in Florida, we were worked together. We worked together for parts of most of Kansas City. Moving up here, you know, we just found it a little easier if I went out and found, you know, like the American Cancer Society or something, because he was an independent producer. So, you know, it's nice to have the insurance covered. It's nice to have some of those financial and fiduciary things covered. So, and the kids were at the point where they were in school all day, so I didn't have to take from them. But, you know, it's been off and on. You never shut it off, and you're always part of it, because he is 24/7. So I may come home, you know, I hit the door like 4:45 from my commute from Hammond. And, you know, he may be asking me to read or edit something. And, you know, it's just what you do. You help each other. He edits my stuff from the chamber to make sure that I sound intelligent. And, you know, I make sure I edit his so that he's got all his stuff spelled correctly and syntax right and all that. So.
And I lure her into projects. You know, I got her on the weekend sometime, and I say, we shot a project called At the Zoo with Max and Mackenzie. Such a fun project, showing the zoo through the eyes of 2 9-year-olds. And I said, "Come on, you got to come on and direct second unit for the project, you know, shooting shots away from the main action." And Kim was gracious enough to do that. So I know she's got the entertainment business in her blood. She started out working with Paramount Motion Pictures with Tom Cruise on Days of Thunder, and then Jack Nicholson in The Two Jakes. So she loves it. And, you know, listen, who doesn't love it? People who are not in my industry, they believe that we who are in this industry do everything with pixie dust and a magic wand. And it's true. You know, sometimes we do use pixie dust and a magic wand, but our business has protocols just like any other. You have to do it by the numbers. But there's times when you're having something happen that's like amazing. It's what they call a movie moment. You would have scripted it in a movie and nobody really believed it could happen. We were down in the Bahamas doing a project called Amazing Grace, an inspirational project about these gangs that were in the Bahamas, and they had a coming to the Lord moment, and they went to the government. They got 10,000 buckets of paint, and they went around all of the inner city neighborhoods painting the beautiful houses and working with the residents there. And we're shooting it in like midnight, and we're on this street, and there's, you know, I mean, it's all actors, but we had ostensibly some that were ladies of the night, and there's gang members, and it's dark in the Bahamas, and in the middle of shooting, this dog trots through frame and he just stops, and he turns, he looks the camera, he turns, he walks off camera, and he goes, "Or, or." I said, "Cut, print." Okay. It was a movie moment, you know. It's magic. And that's the thing that I think keeps Kim still involved in the business. You know, I'm a golfer. I'm terrible at it. You know, I'll hit them like 150 yards. It goes out into the woods and everything. Kim hits them straight down the fairway. And every once in a while, I'll hit one ball, and it goes out. And after about 75 yards, it starts to rise, and it goes 200 yards. And that's how you become hooked on golf.
Yeah, one good shot.
It's the same thing for Kim. One good shot, she said. In this case, it was the shot of that dog.
That's fantastic. You're listening to our guests today, Jack and Kim Olesker, and Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Jack, tell us some of the projects. I know I saw one that, of course, my grandson is always happy about, the Super Mario Brothers, because he's obsessed with Mario and Luigi.
Yeah, that was a wonderful project. That was after I left Deke Entertainment, and I went independent. And Andy Hayward, who amazing guy, I learned a great deal about business from him. He was the president and CEO of Deke Entertainment when we were the largest producer of children's television in the world. And Andy bought the company in a leveraged buyout, and I was one of the highest paid individuals, and he had to terminate me, as he did with a lot of people, to bring their bottom line down. And instead of writing the scathing letter about how I was here at the beginning and everything, I wrote him this inter-office memo, and I said, Andy, I'm so appreciative of everything that you taught me. You taught me how to write a series Bible. You taught me how to go and pitch to Mattel and Hasbro and Lego. And I just want you to know I'm going to miss working at Deke, but I really appreciate everything. And I sent it inter-office, and he came into my office about an hour later. He opened up the door, and he pointed at me, and he said, that was class. And I went home. It was the first time I had ever been terminated, and it wasn't for cause. They just wanted to get their bottom line down. And about 2 weeks later, the story editor for Super Mario Brothers calls me, and he says, Andy wants you to write 5 episodes of television of Super Mario Brothers. Now, who does something like that? That speaks volumes of Andy Hayward, who everybody says, oh, he's such a tough businessman and everything, but a heart of gold. So I got brought on with Super Mario Brothers, and oh, my gosh. You talk about a fun show. You know, Lou Albano, who was a wrestler and a crazy guy, had paper clips in his hair and stuff. He was a maniac over the top. He played Luigi. Okay, he did the voiceover for Luigi. And I see Larry nodding his head. And, you know, to be able to do the shows for that series, you know, King Koopa, you know, this villainous ruler, and all the different characters, that was a real joy for me. I did a wonderful show called Koopa Christmas. It was a wonderful episode, and the spirit of the season touches this villain Koopa's heart, and for a moment they have a pause in their big hostilities towards each other, and they just celebrate the moment. And, you know, you asked a great question, Esther. You said, where do you get your ideas? Well, years ago, the first thing I do in the morning is I turn on all of the news sites, and I watch news for an hour, and I read a lot. And I remember years ago, I read an article that in World War I, there was a Christmas when they were in the trenches. It was trench warfare in those days, when all of the hostility stopped and somebody on the German side started playing a Christmas song. And then somebody on the British side started playing a Christmas song. And they started sticking their heads up from the foxholes and the trenches, and they slowly walked towards each other. People that were putting their lives on the line to battle for whatever they felt was the right thing to battle for. And they started singing Christmas songs together, these German soldiers, these British soldiers, and they started drinking wine and toasting each other. And that's how they spent their Christmas evening. And that's where I reached way back, and I got the idea for Koopa Christmas. So, you know, it's a wonderful opportunity for you, Larry, to let me walk through a byway many years ago with Super Mario Brothers, and you, Esther, asking me where my ideas come from. So I got a 2-for-1 out of that.
So someone coming into the business,
What advice would you give them? I mean, if they want to be a writer doing what you do, what advice do you have for them?
That's a great question, Larry. And I'll tell you real simply. Years ago, I was working in my office, my home office, and our son, Alex, who's our oldest son, he comes into my office. He's about 7 years old. And he said, "Dad, I've decided when I grow up, I want to be a writer, a producer, and a director like you." I said, "That's great, honey." I said, "But why don't you think about a career field a little bit easier to break into, like thoracic surgery or astrophysics?" And he looked at me, but he got it. So thank heavens he ended up going to Purdue University. Now he's a civil engineer. We're very, very proud of him. I would not recommend to anyone to go into the entertainment business. It is so difficult. It is so hard. It is so kind of competitive. When I moved out to Los Angeles, my first novel was a bestseller. MGM bought the film rights. So I thought, this is it. You know, I'm going to have the next Golden Fingers. I didn't realize there were 7,842 people a day that were coming out to LA with the same idea. So when I finally got the job of the week, you know, every morning I would throw out my arms like Yul Brynner in the Ten Commandments chasing after Moses. I'd say, "Bring me my battle armor." You know, there's a joke. It's only half a joke. In the corridors of power at Columbia, two executives are walking towards each other, and one says good morning, and the other one thinks, "I wonder what he means by that." Yeah. So it's a tough, hard business. If you're going to go into it, you don't need Jack Olesker to tell you to go into it. You are already a writer, a producer, and a director. Even if you have not published something that you've written, even if you have not produced anything, even if you have not directed, you simply move from this point in time to that point in time. But I will tell you, every time you start on a new project, you are standing in the foothills of K2 or the Matterhorn or Everest, and you're looking up at a 25,000-foot trek, and it's an arduous journey. So you want my advice? You better have guts made out of cast iron. You better have a sense of intrepidity, the strongest work ethic of any person that's around you, and a determination that says, "I'm going to get there." If you have those three things and you have the God-given talent, you're going to make it eventually.
Well, that's great advice. I'll tell you, Jack, I think you're right. You need to have the spine to be in any kind of show business.
Yep.
Yeah, lots of resilience.
Lots of resilience.
So, Kim, I want to like take it to a different place. And I was just so, when I found out that you had the yarn shop. So where does all that, I just love that because I'm, you know, textile maniac. Yeah. So how did that fit in your, you know, in your knitting?
That is a segue, huh? So I started knitting when we had our second child, because I was like, everybody makes these cute little things. I wanted to make them. And so I took lessons in Kansas City, and then we moved up here, and I was like, there's no yarn shops. There was one in Valpo, which at the time seemed like an eternity away. Of course, now, you know, it's no big deal, but they've closed. And so I, you know, mentioned to Jack, at that point in time, I was the director of housing for my sorority. So I was managing 110 sorority houses, a lot of sleepless nights there. But you know, I said, you know, there's no yarn shop up here. Wouldn't that be fun to open a yarn shop? Lo and behold, I think a month later, we opened a yarn shop. And so we put it in a little bungalow in New Buffalo, right across from what's now the Beer Church. It was an actual church when we were across the street. And we had a Faima. We had a beautiful espresso, you know, espresso. We had couches. Women would come in there at 9 when we opened, and they would stay until 5 when we closed. And so it created such an amazing sense of community and support, because a lot of them were Chicago transplants. It's so hard to meet valuable friends after a certain point in time if you don't have kids in school. And even then, are they real, you know, if you're lucky enough, you have good friends there, but it's not like friends. So we developed such a rich group of friends. We opened in 2005, we closed in 2008. Because of the economy in 2008, nobody was coming up to New Buffalo, certainly not buying yarn. And we had our third child by that point in time. So we were like, you know, probably time to close up shop, you know, so, but we are still friends with those people today. I play Mahjong with them. We get together for lunches and coffees. We check in on each other. It's an amazing group of women.
And
mostly women. We had a couple guys.
I got lured into the business. You know, I'd come in and I'd make the espressos for the women in the shop, and I fell in love with the knitting industry. And again, you know, I took the idea about a couple that owns a yarn shop in a resort village, and he used to be a producer for murder mysteries, and her brother is the sheriff in town, and there's a murder in the town. A guy found a beach with a set of knitting needles in his chest, and they get drawn into
a yarn throat. Around his throat.
So I wrote a novel called Cast On, Bets Off, and I published that, and it was very successful. It only went to the yarn shops, and you know, one of my friends said, "Jack, how did you feel writing that novel? You know, it's so close to you and Kim. How did you feel about it?" I said, "Well, it was like writing a 244-page love letter. And I'm fortunate that I got somebody that deserves to have a 244-page love letter written to her."
Well, in our last few seconds here, how can people find you online, contact information, things like that, real quickly?
For me, you can go to jackolesker.com. And there you'll get all the background information that you need on me. And have fun following my column in the New Buffalo Times every week. A writer's life during the golden age of television animation. I have a lot of fun reliving a lot of memories with that, just as I have with many thanks to you, Larry, and Esther for allowing me to go on this path where I could revisit a lot of my happy memories in my industry and with my beloved Kim.
And I'm at lakeshorechamber.com, so you can find me there.
Find you there. Well, that's Jack and Kim Olesker. They've told us their life story here on Art in the Air and shared that with us. We appreciate you coming on the show, and hope to talk to you again in the future. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Have a blessed day.
Yeah, thank you. It was a sweet pleasure.
Thank you, Esther.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.